on VOA Africa.
Hello there. Today is Tuesday, September 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hillary Clinton's health takes center stage in the presidential campaign.
I don't think it's going to impair her in any way.
Global warming shakes up life as we know it.
So we're talking about changing the physical structure of the cold ocean.
President Obama is a funny guy with a little help.
I invited Luther, my anger translator.
Hold on to your lily white butts.
Also ahead, Miracle on the Hudson, the movie. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the issue of health has now made its way into the U.S. presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton says she got dizzy but didn't lose consciousness when she stumbled on the way out of the 9/11 memorial on Sunday. The Democratic presidential candidate told CNN's Anderson Cooper Monday that she was diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday. She said her doctor advised 5 days of rest, but Clinton says she didn't follow that very wise advice.
Like a lot of people, I just thought I could keep going forward and power through it, and obviously that didn't work out so well.
She said she didn't immediately disclose the diagnosis because she just didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal. Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center, was asked about the impact of pneumonia.
I think pneumonia is a common condition. It often is undiagnosed in people. It's something that you treat with antibiotics usually and rest and making sure that people have liquids. I don't think it's going to impair her in any way from running the campaign or assuming office.
Kaplan recently co-wrote an opinion article with Dr. Jonathan Moreno, professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, on the very issue of presidential candidates and health. And Dr. Moreno joins me now to talk more about it. Now, doctor, this article was written before Clinton's diagnosis. Why did you decide to write it?
Well, what motivated that piece really was reflecting on the age of the candidates, not only Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump, but also Senator Sanders, 68, 70, and I think 73 or 74 in the Senator's case. We've never had such old candidates before. And it was only a matter of time, I think, before this question came up, if not with these people, then eventually, because there have been so many incidents involving medical problems with presidents, that as the whole population ages, we're going to have more, I think, older candidates, because people are more vigorous, I'd like to think, in my early 60s than they used to be. So we're going to have people who are going to be older running for high office. So we decided to write this piece, and it turned out to be remarkably timely. I think the main point of the piece is not necessarily to advocate that, you know, candidates for president should have physical exams routinely, but if they are going to publicize their medical condition, they shouldn't be able simply to pick and choose who their doctor is. And they shouldn't be able to draft a completely nonsensical or have some doctor sign a completely nonsensical statement about their health the way Mr. Trump's doctor did at the end of last year. It makes a mockery of the process. If there are going to be public concerns about the health of their candidates for the highest office in the country, then let's at least take it seriously. And we argued that a very credible place to have a physical exam would be the Bethesda Naval Medical Center, which has taken care of many presidents over the years in the past. And it's also important that it be the same panel of physicians for both candidates, because not only is it true that it's not written in stone exactly what should be included in a routine physical, that can vary, but also doctors use, to some extent, their clinical judgment when they assess somebody's medical condition. And that judgment can be, you know, varied among doctors. So I think it's very important to standardize the criteria and the nature of the judgment that's finally made about the candidate's health, if we are going to go down that road.
It sounds like you took issue with at least the letter that Donald Trump presented, which was from a gastroenterologist.
And even that physician fessed up a couple of weeks ago and said he thought it was off the cuff. There was a limousine waiting outside. He even confessed that he might well have incorporated the kind of language that his patient, Mr. Trump, uses. So all in all, it was frankly, you know, an embarrassment to the profession. And again, if we are going to have these candidates for presidency say anything at all about their medical condition, at least let's do it in the soundest way possible. It may be that we shouldn't do that. They shouldn't say anything at all. But if they're going to say anything, let's at least do it in a smart and sound way.
Do you have any view on whether the public does, in fact, have a right to know the health history of candidates running for the highest office in the nation?
You know, I'm not going to say it's an easy call because, after all, what would you include in that physical? And would you go, as many of my psychiatrist friends say, you know, what they really need is a psychiatric assessment. I'm not sure I'd go that far. What is unique about the U.S. system, though, is that the commander-in-chief really can, as we've learned over the years, can do pretty much what he or she wants in the military sphere. And that, I think, is reason for special concern. There are very few limitations, at least in the short run, on what the commander-in-chief can order the men and women of the armed forces to do. So that, I think, you know, does represent a reason to think very seriously about this question.
You know, we've had a lot of armchair doctors in this country during this political election, including psychiatrists who have diagnosed certain things with Donald Trump, calling him, say, a narcissist. And with Hillary Clinton, we're hearing, you know, she has, you know, I mean, we've heard all kinds of things. She has Parkinson's. She has this. She has armchair doctors, I guess you would call them, people that are just sort of speculating but putting things out there. I would imagine you would see that as unethical.
So the psychiatrist case is a unique one because only the American Psychiatric Association, since an episode involving Barry Goldwater back in 1964, has said specifically that psychiatrists, members of the American Psychiatric Association, should not use their professional judgment to make long-distance diagnoses of political candidates. The American Psychological doesn't require that. The American Medical Association doesn't have that kind of a ban. It's really unique to psychiatry. Nonetheless, I would say it is a very bad idea for any healthcare professional to make such a statement without having the opportunity both to examine the patient and also getting the patient's consent to talk about the results of that examination. It politicizes the profession. I think it's inappropriate.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. That is Dr. Jonathan Moreno, professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, who in recent days has speculated about Clinton's health, says he hopes she gets better soon. He's running mate, though, Mike Pence, says Trump will be releasing details about his most recent physical examination in, quote, the days ahead. Let's turn now to what's trending online with social media reporter G. Abby Lee. G, I hear people are talking about the Muslim holiday of Eid.
Hi, Lori. Hashtag Eid al-Adha is a globally trending hashtag, and when you use it, an image of Kaaba shows up automatically. Do you know what a Kaaba is?
No, I do not.
It's the black and gold building located inside Mecca's sacred mosque, and during the Hajj, it's the focal point of pilgrims' prayers. The United Nations shared a video clip of its Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wishing a blessed Eid to Muslims around the world. The video is captioned as, "Let us draw on our common humanity to build a better world for all." Ban Ki-moon's message for hashtag Eid al-Adha.
So, Eid Mubarak means blessed Eid, but what does Eid al-Adha mean?
Actually, I had to look it up myself. So the literal translation is a festival of the sacrifice, and it refers to the second of the two Muslim holidays celebrated every year around the world. Now, the second trending hashtag I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention is hashtag Instagram.
Oh, yes, that's right. Now, the company tweaked the app a bit, right?
That's right. A small change, but huge reaction on social media. At Instagram and Twitter shared a link to a statement by its co-founder and CEO, Kevin Systrom. The new feature is called a keyword moderation tool that lets you list words that you find offensive or inappropriate. So if you do that, comments with these words will be hidden from your posts. So for example, I'm on there at nograin_nogain, and if I find the word Apple offensive, then I can include that in that keyword moderation tool so that I won't see any comments with the word Apple.
So what's the reaction like to that?
Some people are saying they're worried about businesses and might use this tool to remove constructive reviews about their service. And another popular opinion is asking Instagram to add the feature of removing unwanted tags by other people. That's all for me today, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Obama pushes Congress to pass bills to fund the government and fight Zika. Duterte wants U.S. forces out of the South Philippines. Zimbabwe denies charges of partisan food aid distribution. Californians weigh competing death penalty measures. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A ceasefire came into effect in Syria at sunset on Monday in the latest attempt led by the United States and Russia to bring some quiet to the 5.5-year civil war. Residents and observers reported quiet in most of the country hours after the truce came into effect, though activists said airstrikes took place in contested areas around the northern city of Aleppo. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
The earliest reports are that there's some reduction in violence, as well as a few reports of fighting here and there.
Kerry also said the Syrian government must allow deliveries of humanitarian aid into the besieged areas, including the rebel-held districts of Aleppo. Well, the first week of the truce will be crucial. Joining me now to talk more about it, Cameron Munter, CEO and president of the East-West Institute and former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. Thanks for being here. So, sir, how did the ceasefire actually come to fruition?
As far as I know, the agreement came as a result of very long and painstaking negotiations between Secretary Kerry and Minister Lavrov. So they had been talking for a very long time. The backdrop had been that President Obama and President Putin had met in the G20 in China, and there had been no breakthrough. So no one had really thought that, you know, there might be this kind of agreement, but it turns out they came up with a ceasefire.
What exactly does this agreement consist of?
There are a number of elements. One of it is a 7-day ceasefire, a test period, as Lavrov called it, in which one of the key elements is that the Syrian Air Force would not be flying, and therefore, in the American opinion, you know, there is the work that the Syrian Air Force had done had not only been fighting the rebels, but had also been various times in which they had been accused of fighting their own people. So, you know, the barrel bombs, the accusations of poison gas and all these kinds of things. So a 7-day period in which there would be a ceasefire, and we would see whether there would be the ability of the Americans and the Russians to press their, in the Russian case, the government of Assad, in the American case, the non-terrorist resistance movement, to come to terms, to come to the negotiating table to talk about the future. And I think one of the key elements here is that there was an agreement that they wanted to separate the terrorists from the non-terrorist opposition. So, you know, broader questions, an agreement about, you know, what is the role of Assad in the country? What is the role of Russia? What is the role of Turkey, et cetera? Those broader questions, I don't think they're addressed. It's a question of having a 7-day period in which there is a ceasefire, humanitarian access to the estimated 300,000 people in Aleppo who are suffering terribly, and an effort to try once again to get the people who the Americans and the Russians can affect to come to the table to talk about peace.
Is there a path to peace as long as Russia supports the Assad regime?
Well, some of the speculation in the press I thought was very interesting, that the Russians, there's speculation, we don't know this, whether the Russians would say that in the long run, they don't necessarily, they aren't wedded to the idea that Assad stays forever. That is to say, the assessment of some people is that what the Russians are interested in is stability in the region, avoidance of chaos, rather than necessarily the survival or the long-term role of Assad. And so I think from the Western point of view, there's the question, would there be a solution If during this period you can begin to talk, this period of ceasefire, you can begin to talk about power sharing, or you can begin to talk about autonomy or other kinds of arrangements in the country beyond the civil war, the question, it's a very big question, is whether the Russians would be willing to say part of that is a transition away from Assad's rule. No one really knows that, but I think a lot of people in the West are hoping for that.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Cameron Munter, CEO of the East-West Institute in New York. A group called The Sentry that investigates the funding of African conflicts says it's found evidence of huge war profiteering by some of South Sudan's top political leaders, including the heads of the two sides of the country's civil war. The group's co-founders, Hollywood star George Clooney and activist John Prendergast, shared the findings Monday at a news conference at Washington's National Press Club.
The evidence is thorough, it is detailed, and it is irrefutable. It involves arms dealers, international lawyers, international banks, international real estate. And it is because of these international actors that we are also able to provide solutions to help end this criminal behavior, to protect innocent civilians.
Well, the report accused the South Sudanese president and former first vice president, as well as South Sudanese generals, of stealing millions of dollars from state coffers since 2005, when a peace agreement that paved the way for the South's independence from Sudan was signed. Clooney urged the United States and other governments around the world to stop the stolen money from moving through the international financial system. Well, according to a new report, global warming is shaking up life in the world's oceans, spreading disease, destroying coral reefs, and threatening to wipe out global food security. 80 scientists from 12 countries released their findings last week at the International Union for Conservation of Nature meeting in Honolulu. The experts say oceans have absorbed more than 90% of all the extra heat caused by global warming over the last 40 years, causing a dramatic change in the rhythm of the seas. Joining me now to talk about this, Dr. Sarah Myrie, climate scientist and oceanographer at the University of Washington.
It's not just a question of changing weather patterns and changing the temperature of the atmosphere. The ocean system and the atmospheric system are this really beautiful coupled physical and biological system that when you change the concentration of greenhouse gases, yes, you do warm the atmosphere, but there are all of these physical, chemical, and biological consequences to those changes. And so we as people are really dependent upon where we find different kinds of ecosystems and where we find different kinds of animals. And as the planet warms, as the chemistry of the ocean changes, animals are experiencing those physical and chemical changes, and they're either going to move to different environments. The habitat that they're dependent upon is going to shrink or change. And so there are all of these ecological consequences that come as a package along with climate warming. And for me, as an oceanographer and a climate scientist, these are unprecedented changes in the history of human use of these kinds of resources. The kind of climatic change that we are precipitating on the global ecosystem is unprecedented in all of Earth's history.
Can you give us some examples of what you mean?
One example is as the planet warms and as the ocean warms, the amount of dissolved oxygen in the interior of the ocean is changing. In a lot of places in the ocean, so we're seeing an expansion of what has been sort of casually called dead zones, but these are really weird and interesting environments that have low dissolved oxygen concentrations, and many, many organisms in the ocean are really sensitive to oxygen. They need oxygen to respire. So as these low oxygen zones expand, we see the reduction of habitat for organisms that respire oxygen. And this has big consequences to the kinds of the sort of carrying capacity that oceans have to sustain productive fisheries. I'll give you another example. As waters warm, the spread of diseases in the marine environment is a part of that story. Marine diseases can be, particularly diseases for like coral reefs, are expanding as waters warm. As animals become closer to their physiological thresholds of tolerance, they become more and more susceptible to disease. So those are just a couple examples. These are really big physical system changes. So we're talking about changing the physical structure of the whole ocean. And there are all of these biological consequences from that that are, they're so big, it's really hard to even hold them in your mind. We're talking about planetary scale change.
Dr. Sarah Meary, climate scientist at the University of Washington, thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Who is the man behind U.S. President Barack Obama's witticisms? Well, what school does one need to attend to become the joke writer for the occupant of the Oval Office? That's what Ahir Tsikhanyka of VOA's Russian service set out to discover.
I'm a mellow sort of guy. And that's why I invited Luther, my anger translator.
Hold on to your lily white butts.
Meet David Litt. Until recently, President Obama's speechwriter and the inspiration for his anger translator, Luther.
I spent about 4 or 5 years in the White House writing a lot of speeches, and I got to do several of the correspondence dinners, you know, where the president's telling jokes.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is an annual event where the glamour of Hollywood celebrities, flamboyance of well-known journalists, and the comedic talent of the most serious man in U.S. all mix together. For a number of years, David Litt has been the lead writer for the humorous remarks delivered by President Obama at this event.
The president tells jokes, but he's the president the day before he tells the jokes, he's the president the day after he tells those jokes, so you need to make sure that he's addressing things that he would be addressing in some form or another, even in a more serious speech. And that tends to be the focus of these topics.
Traditionally, the president pokes fun at the American political and business elite.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell?
President Obama also happens to be a really funny guy. He has a real sense of humor, and that comes through, and he knows how to use that sense of humor effectively, you know, when he's speaking in public.
President Obama started to demonstrate his sense of humor early on in his speeches as the head of state.
I have to confess I really did not want to be here tonight, but I knew I had to come. Just one more problem that I've inherited from George W. Bush.
As the years passed by, his jokes evolved, as did the president himself. And he never hesitated to own up to
that. And this one is from 2 weeks ago. These days I look in the mirror and I have to admit, I'm not the strapping young Muslim socialist that I used to be.
One of the points of these dinners is it's a chance for the president to take himself down a peg, you know, remind people that he doesn't take himself too seriously, even though he takes the job seriously.
Where did you go to school to be a joke writer for the president?
I studied history in college, so I did not study joke writing. I did improv comedy and I did stand-up comedy when I was in high school. I grew up in New York City, so I used to go to amateur nights and do stand-up. The number one thing you see in successful speechwriters is they tend to be very curious and they tend to read a lot. And they're interested in connecting dots in surprising ways.
Today, David Litt heads the Washington office of the humorous video portal Funny or Die, created by Hollywood actors and producers. Igor Tikhonenko, Dmitry Shahov, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the story of an American pilot whose quick thinking saved the lives of 155 people landed at number one in U.S. movie theaters over the weekend. American audiences came out in droves to watch Sully, a dramatization of The Miracle on the Hudson.
Texas 1549, if we can get it for you. Do you want to try to land runway 13?
We are unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Actor Tom Hanks stars as Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who made the heroic split decision to make an emergency landing of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 into New York's Hudson River in January of 2009.
This is the captain. Brace for impact.
The Warner Brothers film took in $35.5 million in ticket sales, according to estimates on Sunday. That far surpassed the $10 million expected. Critics and audiences are praising the film, which was directed by Clint Eastwood.
Miracle on the Hudson. That was kind of a good omen in a bad period.
Anna Gunn, Laura Linney, and Aaron Eckert co-star. The film also explores the investigation of the landing by the National Transportation Safety Board and the impact that had on the traumatized pilot who had to endure second-guessing by investigators.
No one warned us. No one said you were going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
You've been listening to International Edition. We are glad you could join us. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Follow me at Lori London. Thanks so much for being here. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a while, it looked like the 2.5-year-old civil war in South Sudan might finally be over. In August of last year, both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace agreement to end the conflict, the terms of which confirmed Salva Kiir as president and returned Riek Machar to government as the first vice president. But just months after Riek Machar returned to South Sudan to resume his vice presidential duties, violence resumed and Machar fled. One of the most heinous aspects of South Sudan's civil war is the forced conscription of child soldiers, children younger than 18, with far too many under the age of 15. According to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, since South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013, over 16,000 children have been recruited into armed groups on both sides. UNICEF has reported on the recruitment of child soldiers since the July 7th outbreak of violence. Both sides are using various methods, including coercion and blackmail, to force parents to surrender their children to them. The United States is profoundly alarmed by the UNICEF report. Above and beyond our calls for an end to ongoing violence in South Sudan, we insist on an immediate halt to the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers by government and opposition forces. Individuals responsible for the unlawful recruitment or use of child soldiers for armed groups or forces may be subject to sanction under U.S. law and may be targeted for U.N. sanctions, said State Department spokesman John Kirby in a written statement. The continued unlawful recruitment and use of children in armed conflict in South Sudan is unacceptable. Eliminating the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers for armed groups in South Sudan is a leading priority of the United States. We remain committed to securing accountability for those who recruit and use children as soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is 4.